Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, with New Books in Architecture, a special mini-series in landscape architecture. If you have any ideas for books, please drop me a line. My email is plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. Thank you so much, and I hope you enjoy the following interview. I'd like to welcome you to today's show. The book we will be discussing is Cultural Landscapes of South Asia, Studies in Heritage, Conservation, and Management, edited by Kapila Silva and Amita Sinha, published by Routledge in 2017. Hello, and welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having us on the show.
Let's start with Kapila. Could you tell us about yourself and your educational background?
Sure. Thank you very much for having us for this podcast today. I'm an architect, and right now I teach at the School of Architecture and Design at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Kansas. I'm originally from Sri Lanka, so I did my bachelor's in architecture and master's in architecture in Sri Lanka, and then also I have a postgraduate diploma in architectural conservation. So I practiced in Sri Lanka and taught at the university over there too. And then in 1998, I came to USA, to the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee to pursue my doctorate in architecture. And having completed that, I taught at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee and then later joined the University of Kansas. So I have been here in Kansas now for about 12 years.
Oh, wow. And so, Amita, how about you?
I am also an architect. My architectural education, undergraduate education, was in India. And I came to the U.S. in 1983. And I got my master's in architecture from Virginia Tech and my PhD in architecture from University of California, Berkeley. And then I joined as a tenure-track faculty member at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in the Department of Landscape Architecture. I taught in the department for 29 years, and I retired last year, and I have worked on cultural landscapes and heritage issues in India. That was my major research agenda while I was teaching, and it continues as I work further. I was a Fulbright scholar twice, once in 2009 in New Delhi, Indian National Trust for Art and Cultural Heritage, and more recently last year in the Indian Institute of Technology, Kharagpur, which was actually my alma mater.
Oh, well, so what was, we'll go back and forth, what was your motivations for writing this book?
Yeah, so in the course of my teaching and research at the University of Illinois, I did a number of projects with my students on heritage sites, the most famous one being the Taj Mahal in Agra, and then Varanasi Ghats, which are iconic sites. And so my research projects, they are grounded in this fieldwork and developing landscape planning and design and management proposals with students and faculty. Kapila and I presented our work in several conferences, and in 2013, I'd organized a conference, a one-day symposium at the University of Illinois, and Kapila and several others who had written for the volume presented papers, and we decided that we should bring this together between the covers of a book, and we approached Rutledge because we wanted to look at not only differences, but more importantly, similarities in the way that the six countries of the subcontinent have a shared heritage and also shared values, as well as, you know, the institutions and the regulatory policies are similar because of their colonial background.
As Amita mentioned, that in the South Asian region, the conservation of architectural and cultural heritage has been kind of regulated by the policies established by the colonial administrations in the 18th and 19th centuries, and even early 20th century. And the even after the independence in these countries, the heritage management has been driven purely through these kind of Eurocentric colonial frameworks. And these frameworks do not necessarily address the complexities of cultural heritage in terms of creation of heritage and maintenance of heritage, use of heritage, the meaning of heritage, etc. So in addition to that, in 1972, UNESCO started the World Heritage Program, identifying outstanding cultural heritage sites and also natural heritage sites around the world, and giving these places world heritage status. However, the UNESCO program has also been based on a Eurocentric understanding of what cultural heritage is, mostly thinking about kind of isolated monuments and some archaeological sites. So when it came to that kind of an understanding and framework would work for mostly for European and colonial places and countries, but not necessarily in the non-Western traditions. Eventually, UNESCO also recognized that there's this kind of very complex way cultural heritage has been understood in different parts of the world. So in 1992, UNESCO introduced this idea called cultural landscape approach to understanding various locations around the world and developing and promoting a kind of very holistic kind of framework where you see the human-made places and natural places go together beyond simple monuments and understanding the place in a more holistic sense. So what we also realized is that that's a much more useful framework when you look at the cultural heritage in South Asia, not only to understand the complexities and sophistication of those places, but also how to manage, preserve, and continue those cultural heritage places. So that was also the reason why we wanted to focus on South Asia and to talk about cultural landscape approach and how to understand how to look at these places from a much more holistic frame of view.
I want to say for our audience to know that I have visited India and north, south, east, and west, and I didn't make it to Sri Lanka, but I got close. And right across the water, right across the pond there. The impact from each state was just it was interesting and it was outstanding. And just the language, food, everything, how different it is. So I did find that while we studied historical sites, of course, in school, that we didn't have a lot of education about South Asia, which is why I was interested in your book. Well, how do you think that this book can be applied to designers, or what do they need to know about South Asia that they can learn from you all to apply here to the U.S.?
That's a good question. South Asia is a very diverse land, and it has, you know, multi-layered, you know, history, and it goes back, this history goes back to really a prehistoric time. We call it Indic, you know, the very ancient times. And that's what, you know, kind of unites, I think, the six countries. That is a cultural substratum. Now, I think what the United States, the audience and readers of the book here can learn from the book, from our edited volume, is that local cultures and regional cultures are very important in placemaking, and that one has to be really, you know, sensitive to that in developing programs for heritage conservation, in policy making. So landscape, you know, is not just a view, but it is a cultural construct, and it really reflects, you know, the cultures and subcultures, values, and belief system. So, for instance, in North America, Native American cultures had a different relationship than the European cultures with the land, and with the rivers and with the vegetation. And this relationship was based on harmony with nature. And I think that is what really I see in the ancient cultures of the Indian subcontinent, which have persisted, I think subsisted even to the 20th and 21st century. So I think in the U.S., as National Park Service and other organizations manage national parks, and as practitioners work on urban landscapes, the emphasis should be on ecological processes, but also on landscapes as cultural constructs, and that includes, you know, being very sensitive to social processes.
Silva?
As Amita mentioned, that one of the interesting things about kind of South Asian locations, cities and other villages and larger geographic landscape, is that this kind of multi-layered aspect of it. It's multiple histories, multiple ethnic groups, multiple religious groups or religious identities, and then it's not only buildings and towns, it's also the way the natural landscape has been integrated into the human habitations, and multiple meanings that people have created for these places, even aspect of natural landscapes like rivers and rocks and mountains are given meanings and names and identities and personalities and integrated into a larger cultural milieu. So what you see is a very complex, very mixed places. You don't necessarily see, if you go to an Indian town or any town in South Asia, you don't necessarily see residential areas separated from office areas, or they are separated from religious areas or industrial areas. They all happen in the same place in many ways. And that mixed used, compact, very connected creation of landscapes has always been a very sustainable way of living in that part of the world. Although when you go there, you might be overloaded with sensory information, and you might feel like that's very chaotic, very noisy, etc. But within that that kind of apparently chaotic nature is a very interesting cultural order that creates a very sustainable shared spaces for people to live. So now, today, after going through a suburbanized creation of landscape in the 1950s, the architects and urban designers and urban planners in the U.S. Are recognizing that creating connected, compact, complete, mixed-use neighborhoods are the future if you really want to live in a sustainable manner. So this is a lesson you can actually learn from the South Asian landscapes, that the complexity that is maintained within this landscape. Now, when Jane Jacobs in 1960s wrote about the death of great American cities, one of the things that she mentioned is that we need to understand what kind of a problem a city is, and she called it an organic complexity. And her critique about contemporary American urban planning and urban design was that we try to separate, we kind of create places that doesn't have this kind of complexity, thinking that is the best way to create landscapes, and we are losing so much richness and sustainable aspect of a city by doing that. And her argument was exactly is about having that complex places that everybody can live in a much more shared way. So I think that's something that is still there in South Asian cultural landscapes that we can learn from.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I didn't think about that. So I'm sure one day I'll go back to visit the Asian countries and look at it from a whole different perspective of, yeah, living with harmony and how we've kind of, I don't know, that's a curious question, maybe for another book, is I wonder if European cultures lived more in harmony with nature at the beginning and how they became disconnected from that.
That's very possible. Prehistoric Europe, very possibly was, you know, centered on goddess worship, and God, the land is goddess. We do see it in some places in the womb, you know, caverns of Malta, and slowly, I think over time, patriarchy took over, and also the biblical notion of stewardship kind of was neglected, but nature was seen as a resource to be exploited. So I think with increasing control over resources, and especially mechanization and industrialization, has led to over-exploitation and disconnect, you know, between the between culture and nature, between human beings and the natural world, which I think now it is time to, in the face of climate change and how as civilizations we are at risk, maybe it is time to reconnect with nature in a more in a harmonious way.
Yeah, well, that's such a big and huge lesson for all of us. I'm in the Florida Keys here in Miami, and sea level rise is right at the literally at the top of our minds. So can you tell me more about maybe a project or something you're thinking about in this book that that really like explains how to do it, how a particular place connects people to nature? Can you give me some more specifics?
In the edited volume, The Cultural Landscapes of South Asia, yes. We have a number of chapters actually focusing on that topic of harmony. If I look through the four parts, I would call attention to Nilan Khoury's Landscape Theater of Sigiriya. I would also draw the attention to the Chapter 11, Tourism, Liquid Modernity, and Bhutanese Traditional Landscapes, the chapter by Kapila on Bhaktapur, Nepal.
Just pick one. I threw you a curveball.
I think this is a kind of an underlying current through all the chapters, but especially in part three, the intangible heritage and cultural landscapes, and the four chapters included in that. And towards the end, I write two chapters in which I talk about cultural landscape conservation, and I talk about also the relationship, you know, between culture and nature, and how, you know, conservation programs should be grounded in field work, and in field work usually unearths, you know, the local community's relationship with nature, which is very different, you know, from the institutional perspective, which is more infrastructure based.
Silva?
So if you need a specific example, let me go to the chapter that I wrote about Bhaktapur, Nepal, where how kind of the natural landscape has been an integral part of the cultural landscape. In the entire kind of the Kathmandu Valley, the evolution of the Kathmandu Valley human habitation is also based on the way that people understood that particular landscape. I think I have a particular diagram given in the chapter that shows how people understood the nature in a more religious point of view. They started in their culture, in their belief system. They gave various meanings to the natural elements in the landscape. They made these landscapes into a much more divine geography. So they look at the place as a something that needs to be respected, venerated, and protected, and also as a place that actually protect themselves in return. The mountains are given various names, and they are ascribed to different divinities. They are general day-to-day life and various seasonal activities are performed in a certain way to integrate these divinities into their daily lives. Their agricultural practices and the rituals associated with agricultural practices are also related to that level of understanding of the natural landscape as something that gives the kind of bounty that they want to live in that place. So in certain ways, historically and even today, with all the modern facilities and amenities that people live with over there, they still has a deep love and a respect for their natural landscape, and in some way that they understand that their sustenance in that particular place is actually related to that natural landscape. However, there are certain issues going on right now in terms of new development activities and not properly managing the waste in the area. So there are some level of pollution of the land and the air and the water. But generally within people's minds that they they understand that the value of the natural landscape for the continuation of their habitation in that location.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, it's true. And, you know, I suddenly had a thought of, you know, the actually I was born in Hawaii, and their Hawaiian culture and how they gave great respect to their aina, which is their word for land, and their harmony of living in such a an isolated part of out there in just the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and how they adapted to it and respected it.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting observation that when we talk about cultural landscape, we're not necessarily talking about the land, but also the waterscapes become an important aspect of it. That it's very important to understand, not only for cultural heritage conservation, but also for any architectural or urban planning development, to figure it out how people actually understand their natural setting. And how it has been a part of the kind of creation and formation of their cultures historically and even today. Without that understanding, if you really look at the creation of the human habitation as a purely a technical aspect of providing this number of houses with these kind of amenities, you missed a much more important a dimension through which people connect to the place.
Mm. Yes, that's true. And, you know, I was kind of encouraging that with the students recently at our Florida chapter conference. I engaged them, the FIU and UF students, in a charrette. And it was, it was about Madame Pele is the volcano goddess of Hawaii. She creates the land, and how when she meets the sea, there's like this explosion that happens, but that's how land gets formed between the volcano and the ocean, and how interesting that is. So, I'm going to go to another kind of favorite topic of mine. I've always kind of studied festivals, and on page for our audience 159, let's go on to something kind of fun here. The festivals in Bangladesh. Can you tell me more, a little bit about that? I know it wasn't particularly this or the section that you wrote, but how does, you know, their people's love and wanting to do festivals affect spatial designs in the landscape and in the architecture?
So Bangladesh is the newest country in the subcontinent. It became a nation in 1971. And with nation building also came, you know, invention of new traditions. And one of these new traditions is the Festival of New Year. And this festival is celebrated in Dhaka, in the capital, in a very big way, but also in other smaller cities across the country. And the most important thing about this festival is that it is kind of a hybrid. It's hybrid in nature in its sources of celebration, the practices. So even though Bangladesh is predominantly a Muslim country, but this is a very secular festival and borrows a great deal from Hindu festivals across the subcontinent. And the interesting thing about the celebration of this festival is that it happens in in the open public spaces. For instance, in Dhaka, the major core, urban core, where all the monuments are, it begins there, and then it is like processional, and it, you know, winds its way down the major spine, and it is celebrating the new year, the arrival of the spring. It's also celebrating, you know, the arts and crafts. You know, many students and folk artists join in. There are songs, there is good food, and it is truly a public festival. And it was initiated by actually a group of students in the Dhaka University, and then it just caught on, and it has become a very large spectacle almost, but one which is participatory in nature. It exemplifies what is called as kinetic urbanism by Rahul Mehrotra, a Harvard professor, in that that the quality of the urban spaces becomes very rich and intense as a result of activities of people celebrating. And so we have, you know, the material fabric, and that is, you know, these are old, you know, government buildings. And that is tangible heritage. But then the intangible heritage is that of kinetic urbanism. And that is what, you know, the festival brings out.
Kapila, what about festivals in Sri Lanka?
In one of the chapters, I talked about a particular festival in Sri Lanka, in the middle of the country, this particular city called Kandy. It was the last capital of the Sinhalese monarchy before the country went under the British occupation in 1815. So this particular festival has been there for thousands of years, not only in Kandy, but also before Kandy in other capital cities of Sri Lanka, historical capital cities of Sri Lanka. So this particular festival, I mean, the festival is still there. Actually, it's going right now in Kandy in August. Usually, it's in July, August. So it's right now happening in Sri Lanka. So this festival is held to pay respect to the guardian deities of the Kandyan kingdom, historical Kandyan kingdom. And to pay respect to the tooth relic of the historic Buddha. Now, this tooth relic of the historical Buddha was brought to Sri Lanka from India in the 5th century AD. And since then, it has been under the ownership or the custodianship of the king of the country. Although Sri Lanka is not a monarchical administrative system anymore, but it is still considered a very important holy relic in Sri Lanka. And since that earlier times, there had been an annual festival paid homage to the relic, considering the relic representing the historical Buddha. And Sri Lanka is a majority Buddhist country. So this particular relic and this festival has been very important. And the interesting thing is that during the time of the Kandyan kings, the festival was actually a military festival. The entire the city of Kandy was designed historically to represent the macrocosmic Kandyan kingdom. So the city itself was in a miniature replication of the larger kingdom. And when this festival was held in Kandy historically, the festival will kind of go around the city, encompassing the entire city, representing the authority of the king over the entire Kandyan kingdom. So the festival was at the same time a religious festival and a military parade. And this is how, at that time, people understood who is actually holding the authority over the kingdom and what's the kind of the power and the authority the king had, not only militarily, economically, but also in terms of spiritually, because the king was the custodian of the holy relic. Today, even we don't have a king, people still have high regard for the holy relic, and because of that, a very high regard of this particular festival, because the festival actually represents the history of the country, the belief, the predominant belief system of the people of the country, and also all the various cultural traditions and arts and crafts of the country. So it's an important cultural heritage, not only because of it's a festival full of arts and dance and music, but also the way the landscape has been designed, and how a ritual define a landscape, and also how that particular ritual define a particular administrative system at that time in the country's history.
Oh, I had no idea. So it's interesting, the social hierarchy of humans and relationship to place.
Yes, exactly, and it's all represented in a one festival, which has so many different layers to that. Not only religious, cultural, and the idea of the cosmography and administrative system and everything.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, I'm going to jump to a different country for both of you. So this is a fair question about the gross national happiness scale. I just thought this would be a fun question. And the Kingdom of Bhutan. And how do you think this philosophy of social construct of they obviously cherish happiness, how does that relate to their, well, we'll go architecture, we'll go all aspects of architecture, land, buildings, interior, exterior. How do you think in this chapter that that affects their designs of their space?
So when Bhutan adopted this, gross national happiness scale, it was not just, I think, a tourist ploy, but I think it genuinely, I think, reflects in some way their own understanding of Bhutanese culture and landscape. I think has a very integral role in that because the built environment, you know, of the monasteries and of palaces and other structures are this built environment is not in opposition, you know, to the land, to the site, but it is in harmony that it kind of conforms in many ways to the physiography and to the natural processes. So I think that, to me, this is my view, and I think it's also the author's view, is that this really is the key to a way of life which is, rooted to be in harmony, you know, with the landscape. And that is, I think, a cherished heritage, you could call it an intangible dimension of heritage, which is sought to be promoted in conserving the landscape and the heritage structures, and also in, I think, representing Bhutan to the outside world.
Yeah, I think Bhutan has been some kind of an hermit kingdom, kind of isolated from the rest of the world for a very long period of time. And I think when the country started to open up to the rest of the world, I think the king of the country and other ruling elites recognized the fact that pursuing material wealth cannot necessarily be a healthy thing for a very small country with a lot of natural resources in terms of its landscape, that it would not necessarily generate a very healthy society. And Bhutan is also fundamentally a Buddhist country, and one of the Buddhist kind of values or principles or understanding is that the material wealth does not necessarily guarantee your inner peace and happiness. So I think the country recognized that in a vastly capitalistic world, that pursuing material wealth will not be a sustainable goal, especially looking from their own cultural point of view. So in some ways that inner peace and harmony, or the kind of the national happiness, in this case cannot be attributed to a destruction of the natural environment and creation of concrete jungles and glass palaces, and that may not be the way to go. And because of that, they also realize that the historical landscape, cultural landscape, and the buildings and the cities, they were built in harmony with the natural landscape. So they made a very conscious decision to maintain that particular balance that they created historically, and to continue that practice into the future. So if you even go today, some of even the new buildings are built based on that historical architectural styles and practices, and using the kind of building materials that they used. So in some way, they're trying to keep the development in a very harmonized way with the natural landscape, rather than pursuing whatever you may see on posh magazines and TV programs and etc. So they are creating the kind of dream that actually would be very sustainable within what they have within their country.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Yeah, just harmonizing with nature could be a key to happiness.
Yes.
Kind of seeing the whole book. Let me ask you, what was your favorite part about writing this book? What did you enjoy the most about your research in doing this book and editing it and all these essays and going through it?
Well, I think I enjoyed mostly working with the authors and their chapters on other countries, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bhutan and Bangladesh, because I felt that I've traveled a lot within India, but I'm not so familiar with other countries. I also felt that working closely with the authors was meaningful, in the sense that not only was I learning from them, but Kapila and I were shaping up the chapters in a way that the edited volume became a cohesive statement, on South Asian cultural heritage.
Yeah, I would agree completely that the most valuable part and enjoyable part was working with a group of colleagues and learning from their point of view and from their expertise about the subject areas that they were particularly investigating and the locations, and from their perspective, understanding what's happening in each society and how each society is working towards and also struggling various global dynamic forces and trying to maintain a certain kind of a systemic balance within their cultural landscape. So that was the most enjoyable part, actually, working with and learning with.
This is a little bit off from the book, but let's tell our American audience about Namaste and Namaskar, and because this is a South Asian Indian greeting. What does Namaste and Namaskar, what does that mean to you?
I use it as a greeting always, and that is folding the hands and saying Namaste. And I think the word means that homage to the self, to you. And who's you? That is a divine in you. I think that is the ancient Sanskrit meaning. And namaskar, namaste, namaskaram, these are all, you know, kind of variations. I'm not sure how popular this greeting is in Sri Lanka. Kapila might be able to say a bit more on namaskar, but I have always, you know, enjoyed doing this, folding my hands and saying namaste.
Yeah, we don't have the same term, although Sri Lankan language is based on Indian Sanskrit language. We understand the term namaste and namaskar right away because that's you use when you specifically pay homage to the Buddha as a Buddhist. Hindu devotee in Sri Lanka paying respect to a Hindu god. The term that we actually use in our language is Ayubo One, meaning that may you have long life. But the gesture, hand gesture, is the same hand gesture that the Indians would use when they say Namaste. But we use the same gesture and say Ayubo One, meaning
I like that.
You have long life.
So we could say this book is like a, I don't know if I could say it, Kapila, you have to give me that praise again. But Namaste, Namaskar to the land and be in harmony.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Yeah,
what we're doing. Yeah. So I know we've taken up a lot of your time today, and I want to thank both of you for being here. This book is wonderful. I've really enjoyed reading through it. Can you tell our audience what are you working on now?
Oh, thank you. I am working actually on a book which is titled Cultural Landscapes of India, Imagined, Enacted, and Reclaimed. I just completed the manuscript, and it is being reviewed by University of Pittsburgh Press. I'm happy to say that the reviews are very good. And I'm looking forward, you know, to revising it. And this book actually builds upon my earlier book, Landscapes of India, but it also builds on the edited volume that Kapila and I did on cultural landscapes of South Asia. So I am glad that I've been able to continue the work using new case studies and further articulating the concept of landscape, drawing attention to landscape as an image, as an event, and also the necessity to reclaim traditional landscapes and to impress upon, you know, my future reader that the landscape ethic should rest, you know, upon age-old ideas of nature veneration.
I just completed another edited volume and submitted it to Routledge, and the book will come out in January next year. The book is titled Routledge Handbook on Historic Urban Landscapes in Asia and Pacific. There are about 38 chapters. written by various authors in Asia and Australia. So this book is about, again, based on a new concept that UNESCO came up with for the conservation of historic cities in the world, understanding historic cities through a cultural landscape perspective and calling them historic urban landscapes. Amit also contributed a chapter about Varanasi, India, to this particular book. I just started having a conversation with two of other colleagues, Professor David Jones in Deakin University in Australia and Professor Ken Taylor in the Australian National University to work on another edited volume on cultural landscapes in Asia and Pacific. We just started talking about it, and I actually talked to Amit a couple of days ago whether she would be interested in contributing a chapter to that. She said yes. So that's the new project.
Oh, wow. So you guys are just continuing to grow and add to our cultural body of knowledge across the world.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks.
Oh, I think this is great for a U.S. audience, especially if they maybe have not necessarily traveled to South Asia. Like I said, I have, and it was wonderful. Now I'm really going to look forward to going back and seeing this with a different from a different perspective.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. I hope this will, generate some interest, you know, in traveling to South Asia and experiencing the cultures firsthand.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Kapila?
Thank you, Tricia, giving us this opportunity. I hope that that we were able to give some idea about some different idea about South Asia.
Well, thank you. Well,
to your audience.
To let everybody know, this book is, again, it's Cultural Landscapes of South Asia, Studies in Heritage, Conservation and Management, edited by Kapila Silva and Amita Sinha. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening today. This is again Tricia Kaffer with New Books in Architecture, a special mini-series in landscape architecture. And if you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.